Good afternoon, conversing friends. Welcome to the Camden branch of the Socialist Party. This meeting is organized by the Camden branch, and today's reading novel is by Ronco. And I'll make announcement also later. As you probably know, we are contesting the EU election on June 9th, and the main aim of this one is just to propagate our ideas or spread our ideas to the socialist case. And the main agenda today is about the novel, to look and to read the novels and to examine them, what is relevant in the period of history in which they were written and published. Comrade Cook is going to speak for about half an hour approximately. And after that, we will have more discussions in relation to the novel. And our next meeting also will be on the 20th of February, this month, and the title will be 1984 by George Orwell. And the speaker will be Clifford Slapper.
No!
So I'm going to hand to Comrade Ronco to speak for about half an hour.
Good afternoon, everybody. I didn't sleep on a very even keel last night, so you may occasionally see me curling up. That's what it is. It's not very serious, but I'm a bit bent. I think some people might have found it a peculiar choice, Kangaroo. My excuse for choosing this novel is not that Lawrence particularly supports socialism or opposes it. What I think about it, and I think the reason it's stuck in my mind so long, is that he forces us to think about some issues which we often tend to overlook. That's what I'm going to try and show today anyway. For those who haven't had an opportunity to read it, Kangaroo was written quite rapidly in 1922, during the few months that the Lawrences, David and his wife, spent in Australia. In a letter he wrote to a friend of his, Catherine Carswell, he described it as a funny sort of novel where nothing happens and such a lot of things should happen. And rereading it after about 40 years, I found it an uncomfortable experience again. I don't know whether the people who've had a chance to read it found that. I became conscious once again of what an original writer Lawrence was, and still is for that matter. How very different he is from other novelists. He's got very many off-putting mannerisms of style. He's got an unconventional way of handling stories. And it's also off-putting his seemingly limitless arrogance towards his fellow men, certainly, but especially towards women. Now, I don't know whether women could tolerate reading this stuff for 5 minutes. And in his own time, he upset the literary establishment almost completely. He also upset quite a lot of the reading public. Remember, this is just after the First World War. And there's no doubt about it that his writings have continued to anger a lot of people since. He's been called a fascist and all sorts of things. We can discuss that afterwards. One of the things that upset him, of course, was primarily upset him, I should think, was that he was an ordinary coal miner's son from Eastwood in Nottingham. And instead of aspiring to become middle class, like any working class lad with intellectual pretensions was supposed to do, he instead married the divorced daughter of a German baron and lost no opportunity in showing how he despised the capitalist class, the so-called middle class. He not only despised them, he certainly despised capitalism. This is where, contrary to the fascist thing that some people see, other people see a potential socialist thing. The reason, however, that he despised capitalism and the capitalists was not so much the sort of thing that socialists usually see, as the effect he detected that capitalism was having and the class system was having upon personal relationships. Upon the individual personality, first of all, then upon personal relationships, and most specifically upon sexual relationships. And that's, of course, how Lady Chatterley's Lover comes to be part of the whole pattern. that almost theatre of war of personal relationships becomes the dominant theme in virtually all his novels and much of his other writing as well. And one of the things which is difficult to take about him is that he persistently preaches at his readers in his novels as well as in his essays. It's not all he does, I mean, he does dramatise the issues through the characters. These things do happen, particularly, I suppose, probably one of the best is the one I made the film on, Women in Love, of really going into subtle detail about the relationship between people, particularly the relationship, in this case, between men and men and between men and women. Also, the relationship between the sisters, too. The other aspect of Lawrence which has not been so heavily criticised is the way in which, through these individual characters' perception, he introduces a detailed and loving description of the external world. I would say that he's almost unequalled in this ability to convey what a scene is like, particularly what nature is like. And one of the great things about Kangaroo is its evocation of the Australian seaside, because he lived on the seaside, he lived on the seaside there, but also the bush and the Australian flora and fauna in general. Even Australians have got to be models. It's for that sort of reason that Leavis here, who's a critic who's really became the champion of Lawrence's reputation. I think perhaps in a way he's trying to deflect criticism by saying that in a way Lawrence's books aren't so much novels as dramatic poems and should be read much more from a poetic point of view. Unless you are prepared for it, it's strange when you find Lawrence repeating the same sentence two or three times. Novelists don't normally do this sort of thing, poets do, and I think that's the sort of thing that Leavis has got in mind. Kangaroo is about 150,000 words long, and he wrote all of it in 5 weeks, which is going some, 30,000 words a week, you know. And apparently, he sent the very first draft off to the printer. Normally, his technique was never to go back and revise the scripts. It was put it on site, start again from the beginning, and write it all again. But this is the first draft, however, shows, I think. I think the novel is a bit untidy, I think it's repetitive, and I certainly think it's self-indulgent in a lot of places. If you've read it, you'll probably come across that point where he tells the reader, if you don't like the novel, put it down, don't read anymore, you know. It's decided to go over the top of it. And there's an awful lot of his arguing for his dark gods in it. And it crops up two or three times, and he's saying much the same stuff over and over again. But it gets tedious, you can't deny that. The other thing which I think gets tedious is that he's so obviously full of his self-importance, and he oozes from every page. It got so irritating. The first day I started reading it, I slammed the thing down and couldn't get back to it for about another 12 hours. I was so irritated, really. The story, for those who don't know, it is about a married couple, Richard Lovett Summers and his wife Harriet, and it's remarkable how like they are to the D.H. Lawrences in every way, Lawrence and his wife. And these people go and spend some time in Australia, and they rent first a house in Sydney and then a house about 30 miles further south on the coast, a bungalow, just like the Lawrences did. And I think even the names of the houses were the same. One's called Why Work, I think. And the other one was called, as Richard Summers pronounced it when he first gets there, he thinks it's a Russian word, Torestin. She says, no, it means to rest in. So that's the sort of names of the houses. And the names of the people he meets, they live in a house called Cooey. So he's obviously taking the mickey out of the Australians a bit. Anyway, what Lawrence did while he was there was to write. He wrote the book itself, Kangaroo, and he wrote some other stories as well. What his central character does, who's so like Lawrence in almost every way, is to have meetings and long arguments with men who were involved in radical politics in Sydney, or whether that in fact happened or not, or whether those politics happened or not, we don't know. Kangaroo, in fact, after the title, is the nickname given to one of the central characters in the story. He's a lawyer, named Ben Cooley, and as Lodge tells us on many, many occasions, a Jew, and got various Jewish characteristics about him, and you don't know quite what Lawrence's ambivalent attitude is towards Jews. He's the leader of the Digger organisation, and it's composed primarily of returned war veterans. And their policy is not to be overtly political, and they're organised in athletics clubs all over the country. They've been organised about 2 years, and they're sworn to unquestioning obedience to their leaders, just as they were in the army, and their strategy is to wait for a crisis in government, and then, because of their discipline in the organisation, to step in and take control. And the chap who explains all this to Richard Summers, P.S. Lawrence, in the first place, is a man named Jack Colcott, who happens to be his neighbour. And Colcott, of course, makes a lot of soundings on Summers, first of all, to make sure that he's sympathetic, and also to keep his trap shut about all this, because it's fairly secret. And he explains to Summers that they're against socialism, they're against labour, they're against democracy, and they're against politicians. We better watch it from the brilliant politicians, because it's very easy to get branded with that same label. Their first consideration is Australia. They've got a special fear of the Japanese. We were talking to Dick over yesterday, and how the Japanese were saying there are up in Queensland, and so perhaps the fear was not entirely unjustified. They're also afraid of all the inverted commas coloured races that have been conquered by the British Empire, because as they think, all the people, having been so badly treated by the British, will want to get back at the British. And that's the reason they give for being so opposed to the left. But the internationalism of the Workers of the World Unite type would simply give undemocratic foreigners the chance to dominate or even enslave Australia. So that's their excuse for being opposed to them. The word nigger crops up a few times, the word chink for Chinaman crops up a few times, and there's no indication that Lawrence sets himself back from this. I mean, it seems to me that Lawrence is using these terms himself in places. So, again, I think the question of whether Lawrence is a racist ought to be asked. I mean, it's not entirely clear, but it's a suspicion. And one of the interesting things to me of all is that in all this consideration of Australia and the Australian flora and fauna, he never for once mentions the Aborigines. In all his talk about dark gods, he never mentions the Aboriginal religion and so on. However, to revert to the Digger movement, they feel they need strong leaders to protect them from all of these dangers. And, of course, the people who are actually putting these ideas, Ben Cooley and Jack Colcott, are themselves leaders. Ben Cooley is the overall leader, and Jack Colcott is a subsidiary leader. So they would be in favour of leadership, wouldn't they? And the way in which Pseudo-Lawrence... Richard Summers gets involved is that these people have apparently read and admired his poems, and they've read and admired essays on democracy that he's written across in Europe, and have been published in an international journal. And somebody on the ship that Summers arrived on has told Kangaroo about Summers' arrival. And what he wants is some support from the old country, the approval of a man like Summers who's written these essays. He goes so far as to say he wants his love. And this crops up quite a number of times, actually, and I'll refer to it again. Because Kangaroo's aim is to launch a crusade which will, in fact, take over and rejuvenate Australia. He really wants to take over Australia. And he's got, as Lance writes, sort of this Jewish love. And it's pretty obvious that Lance doesn't like it. Now, on the other hand, the other main character is Jack Colcott's brother-in-law, a chap named William James, an ex-Cornishman. And he's involved in the Digger movement, but he's much more sceptical than Colcott. He's also involved with the trade union movement as well. It's he who takes Summers to meet the trade union leader, William Struthers. It's very interesting, the names that Lance picks for these people. Cooley on the one hand and Struthers on the other.
And again, Struthers is supposed to have read and admired. It's all right, I don't mind. If you want to stay, stay. It's not going to stop me. Anyway, he's bored. Suck it and see. What Struthers wants Somers to do is edit a newspaper, a trade union newspaper, which, as he suggests, would put some heart into the Australian working class movements, because the government has there just started to make an attack on wages, has made one reduction in wages and is planning another, and plans actually to cut trade union power. So the trade union movement in Australia is conscious that it's getting a bit now or neverish, and they haven't got the support they want from the working class. And they think that because of Lawrence's writings, they found an ambiguous. You see, on the one hand, the diggers have seen something in it for them, the trade union movement have seen something in his writings for them. They wanted to edit this paper. Now, Lawrence, what he's doing here is posing this hero of his, Richard Somers, with a problem of choosing between these two conceptions, Lawrence's conceptions, of course. On the one hand, fascism of the digger movement, and on the other hand, socialism of the trade union movements, and occasionally calls them Bolsheviks as well, and just does give a speech from Cooley, and you can see that it's roughly along Communist Party lines. And he regards those two, as many people still do today, all this stuff, as opposites. Socialism and fascism are opposite ends of the scale, or opposite poles, and he's got to try and choose between them. And the trouble with the hero of Somers, of course, is that he's too arrogant to enter any movement except as a leader. That's his sort of attitude, and he gives you all his thinking and arguing about this, and after consideration he finds both of them repugnant to him. On the one hand, he finds politics too materialistic and inhuman, and on the other hand, he finds the matiness of these popular movements distasteful, even claustrophobic. What Lawrence puts into his mouth is that he wants individuals to be discrete, not with two E's together, but E-T-E, separate. Separate individuals keeping their distance and keeping their own power. That's quite interesting that Lawrence should think that this is quite different from democracy, because he does seem to think this. In my way of thinking, it's one possible definition of democracy. I think the reason that he doesn't do it is because he believes most people are incapable of it. He believes that they're inferior and they can't stand on their own feet. They've got to have something matey like this. Well, to follow the plot such as it is, there is very little plot in the conventional sense of the story. There is a large trade union meeting which is addressed by this chap, Willie Struthers. And at this meeting, the diggers, who've all collected together rather in the SWP manner, count him out. I don't really know this business, but they all, with nice timing and loud voices, start up. One, two, and they carry on until some of those in the hall can't contain their patience any longer, and a fight breaks out. During the fight, Jack Colcutt manages to kill three of the trade unionists with an iron bar. He talks with glee about the way the one bloke's brain is spurted out. And Kangaroo appears on a white horse, gets shot in the belly. So there's blood on both sides. After that, the hero Richard Somers is asked to visit Kangaroo in hospital, and he does do that, but he doesn't really want to do it. And I think one of the reasons that it's in the story is to show the change in the man, because he's talked about Kangaroo, Ben Cooley, as a sort of godlike figure early on, a very impressive man. And now, wounded and in pain, the more or less deflated character, and in hospital he desperately wants Somers' approval and love. I think one of the functions of this is to show how it's now Somers who's in the godlike position of being able to give or withhold his love of this man. And he refuses to tell the lie that he loves Kangaroo, although Ben Colcutt's saying, you can tell the old bloke that if you want, if you really for a decent sort of chap. He doesn't do it. Kangaroo, therefore, fails to respond to the treatment they're giving him and he dies. In fact, Lawrence titles the chapter, Kangaroo is Killed. So he regards it as not just a passive thing, but quite an active thing on the part of Summers. But really, that's what the whole story is about. It's about what Summers does not do. He sees the political action, and he engages in political discussion, and he thinks about political ideas, but he decides that none of it's for him. Well, we can sympathise to some extent, because it's obvious that neither the fascists nor the communists in the book offer any real hope for the future. But what's sobering to recognise is that how little has changed in 70 years. And that's in spite of all the misery and tragedy caused by fascist movements and communist movements, that really the same sort of oppositions are still going on. The same sort of attitudes of right and left are there about whether they should be counted on the streets and so on. The SWP and the BNP really haven't changed very much. And I wonder, in fact, if working class thinking hasn't advanced at all in that time. I think there are, in many ways, a lot of parallels between the 1920s and today. In fact, Lawrence took those experiences, the conflicts and the arguments between the socialists and the fascists from southern Italy, where he had called on his way, on his cruise almost, down to Australia, because that was going on at that time. And of course, at the time the book was being written, Mussolini was coming to power. Mussolini came to power in October 1922, just about by the time the book was finished, though by that time they had left Australia and not invented it. But that was the atmosphere in which it was happening. That sort of turmoil was in Europe, and now it's not Italy so much anymore, it's Russia and Ukraine and erstwhile Yugoslavia and so on, but the patterns look kind of worryingly similar. And I think Lawrence's book, for all its faults, gives us a feel for that period. A period when the economic gloom and the exposed worthlessness and powerlessness of politicians make democracy seem a hollow sham. And in another sense, he could be said to have dealt with a situation which reflected the days in the sense that the working class was then, on the whole, too easygoing. He said this time and time again about the Australian working class. Too easygoing, very nice people, no harm in them. What was it, that or apathy or feeling beaten down or feeling bewildered to do anything about their condition? But it seems to me that's still around now. I think also in the book, and he's not so explicit about this, and this is what I want to draw out of it, of value, if I can, is that in many of the other things which happens, he reminded us that rational arguments isn't the only factor in persuading people that something is important. It's not the only means we must use to build a large socialist movements. Kangaroo deals with aspects of radical politics which he doesn't comment on. For example, the conflicts or the balance between self-interest and altruism, between seeking power or wealth for yourself on the one hand, or working for a cause that reaches beyond your own circumstances or your own area of the world, or even your own lifetime. He also points up the tension between the destructive, the antagonistic, what we sometimes call the anti-capitalism urge, and the constructive, creative desire to bring about a better, a less destructive society. If I can direct it towards our own publicity for a moment, and our own understanding of socialism. The objective interpretation of historical materialism is that it's class self-interest which brings about revolutionary change. And most left-wing parties are voluble in their class hatred in attempting to gain support. But of course, Marx more than once makes the point that revolutionary movements had never yet had an objective view of what they were setting out to achieve. The English Puritans firmly believed that they had God on their side, that they were fighting in Cromwell's model army to bring about a freer, less corrupt society, rather than liberating and bridal exploitation. And in England today, and I suspect in many other capitalist nations, popular support is most readily engaged for altruistic causes, saving whales or Somali children or ancient woodlands. And up to now, I think that the Socialist Party has failed to find a confident and well-founded balance between its critical, destructive attitude to capitalism and its creative, preservationist, crusading role towards a socialist world. For all its faults, I think Kangaroo encourages us to do that if we read it thoroughly. I think that's the sort of philosophy which comes out of the book. I don't think we've got any time for Lawrence's dark gods, even for another colour. But I do think we must look carefully at what things working class people in particular really care about. And I'm not so sure that we always do that. I think we need to identify those aspects of our socialism which will form the motivational core of an overwhelming social change, as distinct from economic or historical or whatever else you want to look at. I feel sure that the motivational core will lie in the unselfish, idealistic, creative elements in socialism. That's what I think comes out of Kangaroo.